This is Men Matter with Dr. Kevin McGuire and Dr. James Wardner. And tonight, our guest is Mr. Cozio.
Welcome. Kevin McGuire here with Mr. Leon Cozio. Leon, may I address you as Leon?
Sure, absolutely.
Mr. Cozio is a civil rights advocate who's practiced law in New York State for the last 25 years or more. Been featured on multiple talk shows and a very strong advocate for human rights. And I'd like to, Leon, if you would, you're better at giving your own brief CV, so I'll leave you to that at the moment so I don't miss any highlights.
Sure. Thank you. First of all, I want to start by commending you folks for putting on a wonderful program that I think is very important in this day and age to get the message out on a variety of issues that perhaps aren't reaching the mainstream as it should. And so the folks who are listening in are very fortunate, I think, to be a part of this. And so I thank you for having me here as your guest. And my background really spans, at least 25 years in the area of civil rights advocacy, I guess maybe even further back than that when I was president of my student body in college. I took on the dean in terms of what I would call a civil rights violation and was successful and brought it up through the years to where I am today. I have represented victims of race, gender, religious discrimination, ethnic discrimination, folks who speak out, whistleblowers, people who have been discharged for reasons that they spoke out or simply exercised their First Amendment rights. And I'm the guy they call on that comes to the forefront and then challenges the system. And I brought litigation over the years that, knock on wood, I've been fairly successful considering, you know, the uphill battle I faced in many of these situations. I got the largest Indian casino in New York State declared unconstitutional up against large national law firms and the media that folks thought I couldn't succeed with that endeavor. But what brings me here and to you folks today is really something that is perhaps the most profound civil rights violation that remains unremedied in America today, and that is abuse of parents. The abuse of parents, the fleecing of mainstream folks for their money, for their resources, and exploiting children, innocent children, to do so. And so I got in the forefront of this a few years back and decided that I was going to do something about it. I was subjected to retaliation of the kind I never even imagined. I have proceeded with this. And so I am really hoping that with this Parenting Rights Convention that I'm sponsoring in upstate New York in the Syracuse area, that people will perhaps participate and join us in what I think is the last bastion of institutionalized discrimination remaining unremedied in America today. So rather than focus on my background, I think I'd rather cut to the chase and get to the issues I think the folks who are listening in are probably eager to hear about.
That's interesting, and it hits on a lot of the points that we've been addressing, particularly for men. I guess a good place to start would be as surrounding divorce, which is a lot of the topic, and how men, families, women, how people move through the system, it seems from the outset, as soon as you walk into court, there's almost an immediate violation or abandonment of the thought that people in there, families, parents, children, somehow seem to just lose their rights at the outset, and you're thrust into a system that takes off on its own. And a lot of folks, particularly fathers, are sort of left in the lurch and helpless. And it doesn't seem as if there's enough push from either the court side or perhaps the attorney side to say, what's going to happen to you on this journey, on this trip? Is that a fair assessment that we get thrown in and we seem like we're just babes in the woods without anywhere to go?
You know, that's an excellent statement. And in fact, across the United States, if folks were to check their state statutes, the laws on the books, they would learn that the state at the outset declares that through this thing called a parents' patriarch doctrine, that is something where they say the state is the father of its people. And it's really an ancient doctrine. It goes back to, pre-American days, the British and beyond. And it basically states, the days of Sparta, if you want to want to go that far back. And the state essentially controls and owns and lords over the children that are born in the jurisdiction of the state. And the states do this through statutory enactments, and they declare at the outset, for example, in New York State, where I practice, I've practiced for 25 years, and the statute, and I want to preface by saying I'm not so much a divorce lawyer or family court lawyer. I stayed out of that line of practice because from a moral perspective, I mean, if you think of lawyers and morals, it's almost like an oxymoron, but I would stay away from that sort of line of work because I didn't believe in it. I didn't believe in separating parents and children and making money off of it. But that's the essence of what is occurring when folks go into these courts. And the state declares at the outset that neither parent has what is called a prima facie right of custody over their own children. And at the outset, the vast number of people who might read that would not see it. They would see it as an innocuous, perhaps statutory provision. But there's much more, there's something much more fundamental happening there when that statute, and they're very similar across the United States, was passed by the respective legislatures. And, of course, we have that Child Support Standards Act, which kind of oversees all of this and assures that the states are in compliance with this thing called what I call a custodial institutional child rearing. That's where we divide parents and we find a superior one and an inferior one. We call them custodial and non-custodial parents. And then from there, we get all the rights and responsibilities that the courts find are applicable to what were formerly moms and dads. The state seizes the parenting right at the outset when they say that neither parent has a prima facie right in their own children. And that's fundamentally wrong. Not a hearing has occurred. There's not a matter of fitness that's been found. Very simply, the state is saying in that statutory provision, and all the listeners should check their own statutes, and they will find language very similar to that. The state is automatically declaring that it has control over your children. And then the state forces the parents to fight over those children in any separated context. You know, we're simply, for example, in divorce, many people simply they choose to live residentially in a separated environment. It is often better and more productive for child-rearing purposes. Nevertheless, the state comes in and says, well, we have to set apart superior and inferior parents, and that's the way you are now going to raise your children. And even though people cooperate, even in settings where people are working together and raising their children better, for example, in separate environments, the state nevertheless comes in and decides to control the child-rearing environment and tell you how you're going to raise your children. And so when you go into court, you probably don't realize that's already in play before you enter there. The lawyers aren't going to tell you that. In fact, many lawyers probably don't even understand that whole concept themselves. But from a constitutional perspective, from a civil rights perspective, I've seen this all along. And only recently, when I became a victim, I began to formulate the proper constitutional argument to hopefully prevail and set precedent so that parents across America can perhaps finally get back to the role of being proper moms and dads.
How would we make people aware or get them to a position of knowing before they go in? Is that some of what you said, which is pretty startling for me? A lot of that's new for me as well. But in retrospect, I see that it happened. How do we get people aware of, sort of pre-inform them, if they're going to take this step or go into court like that, to ask the right questions? Because you're right, a lot of people don't have the information to say, how can we get around some of this, or how can we fight some of this ahead of time? Because it seems like the system gears up to tear things open and you're stuck. You're pulled one way, then the other. There's evaluations, and the whole crew of the court system comes in. Is this a grassroots thing, or do we approach it through the legislature? How would people go after this?
Well, at the core of it is a civil rights movement. There's no question about it. And perhaps people haven't seen it that in that perspective, but that is what it is. Stripped of its essentials, stripped of the propaganda. What we're dealing with is, the last bastion of institutionalized discrimination, but even more importantly, we're dealing with a form of government oppression that's perhaps never been exploited in quite the manner it has here. It is a multi-billion-dollar industry. Government has found a way to fleece parents, simply by getting them to fight over their children. Now, you need to step back and think about this for a minute, because it really is a brilliant concept. If you are trying to turn government into an industry, which is largely what we're seeing today, then you would simply, you would exploit the oldest and most ancient form of natural right ever known to mankind, and that would be getting parents to fight over their own children, because a mom or a dad, good parents, loving, caring parents, will logically do anything to save their relationships with their children. And, of course, lawyers and politicians know that. Whether they admit it or not, if you want to call it wisdom, the scheme of the laws are designed to exploit that concept, that oldest natural law. And before anybody thinks that this is something new, it really isn't, because the United States Supreme Court has called the parent-child relationship the oldest liberty interest protected by the United States Constitution. And so we are talking about something very fundamental here. But what lawyers and what the system does, if they understand that parents will do this, they will do anything if they love their children. And, of course, those aren't the ones that should be targeted. It's the people who don't care about their children, the ones who abandon them and neglect them. Those parents should be the focus of government energies. But it's not, because the vast amounts of resources and monies can be taken from the working parents, the responsible ones, who are made to fight over their children. And how do they do that? They set up these titles, these power and money awards, as I call them. And then in layperson's terms, as we recognize them commonly, it's called the custodial, non-custodial parent, child support, and visitation concepts that perhaps are more appropriate to prison communities than they are in terms of proper natural child-rearing practices. And so when you get into these courts, you don't know what's hitting you, but what it is a multi-billion-dollar child industry. That's really what we are up against. And so it is a grassroots effort. It's a civil rights movement, but it's probably fledgling only because nobody has really grasped this for what it is, and they really haven't joined on to the movement. And that's why I'm having a parenting rights convention in upstate New York, in the neighborhood of Syracuse, because not far from here is where the first National Women's Rights Convention was held at Seneca Falls. And at that time, 100 people got together and formed a pact and said that we are going to change America. And in fact, they did. And that's really where we are today. We are so far behind on this last bastion of civil rights movements, the last and unremedied one, that folks need to be brought together. And that is my aim, because it's really quite beyond the legal scope. It is something much more fundamental, much more practical. And I think when people recognize it for what it is, they'll understand it, and they are more likely to join the movement.
How can the average person in a circumstance like this use this information to bring that to court or to bring it to bear on their circumstance? Say, for instance, and you brought up an interesting point, custodial, non-custodial parent. I had a discussion one time with an attorney who said, essentially, you've been moved down in either category, custodial or non-custodial. You're almost as if you've been created as a different type or a different class of citizen, a separate one. You're not a father or a mother. You're a custodial or non-custodial, immediately rendering you in a category almost of second-class parent or second-class citizen. Is there anything in play or that can be used to drop that designation in the eyes of the court and bring it back to the court's attention as your rights, as you say, the Supreme Court notice of it, should be paid attention to? Or is that more, as you were discussing, need a movement to change things from without to get inside the court? Has there ever been a successful challenge to that classification of custodial, non-custodial, in order to say this is a civil rights violation? You can't label me as this. I'm a father or a mother.
Well, it's not been done. I think I'm the first person who has brought litigation. I filed lawsuits in February of 2009, which is still pending, and one more recent, which the United States District Court has characterized as a member case. So we have a lead case and a member case presently pending in the United States District Court, a federal court, which rulings could have application throughout the United States if I'm successful. I have challenged this very classification you're speaking to. And to my knowledge, and I've searched the case law, I find nothing even closely resembling this particular challenge. And it is so timely, so on point, that I'm trying to get people either to join the lawsuit or at least support it in some fashion or another. Litigation like this is highly expensive. It is highly demanding. But I'm proceeding with it because my own babies, my own daughters, my flesh and blood, my precious little girls, are impacted by this. So one way or another, much like that natural law I described to you earlier, I'm going to sacrifice everything toward this cause. Let me just read from the opening paragraphs of the lawsuit. This is a preliminary statement. And it reads, the state of New York has maintained a separate but unequal doctrine of parenting laws in domestic relations matters, which is inherently unconstitutional and fraudulently designed in part to exploit children for money-generating purposes. Custodial and non-custodial classifications are mandated in blanket fashion among separated parents to provoke public court contests and a stream of money transfers upon which to generate government support. Mainstream and irresponsible parents are lumped together under this scheme and arbitrarily forced to prove their fitness to the state. Now, therein, the first two paragraphs of the lawsuit in its preliminary statement kind of describes the entire dilemma, the entire problem. The problem that folks will have in reaction to your question when they come into court is the judges themselves have been involved in this money-making scheme. These judges got to their bench because in their prior life, if you will, they practiced law in divorce in family court. They made a lot of money there, and they understand the system. So you're kind of speaking to the enemy when you walk into these courts. Now, let me just dovetail. Let me go back a little bit so folks can understand this from perhaps another historical perspective that is within the lifetimes of most of us still living. If you were to go back to 1950 and some person were to come up and say that, you know, blacks and whites in the schools separate on account of their race is wrong. You know, it's inherently unconstitutional. It's a separate but equal doctrine that doesn't work. It's inherently unconstitutional, all those buzz terms. And the country, the public would think that perhaps such a lawyer, such an advocate, civil rights advocate, was completely off the mark. Something was wrong with this individual. But yet, as we all know, Thurgood Marshall, the African-American lawyer who argued the case of Brown v. Board of Education, made that very point. He said that you can't separate people on account of their race and have separate facilities for blacks and whites in our schools and public institutions. And, of course, that was a little over 50 years ago, and America has been transformed ever since. We look back on those days and we say, my God, did that actually exist? Well, it did. Well, perhaps 40, 50 years from now, people will look back on this very conversation in this very timely radio broadcast, and they'll say, you know what, can you believe that these folks were even talking about that subject at the time? Because we cannot separate parents on account of gender, and that is exactly what we are doing. We are saying that although we have supposedly abandoned the caregiver's doctrines, those are the doctrines that decide who's going to get custody. It's a winner-take-all scenario. And shared parenting goes out the door. And it is a very heinous, oppressive process that from the moment you walk in, you are already burdened. Fathers in particular, and non-custodial mothers, many of mothers are very much supportive of what I'm doing. But this second-class parent, it's much more than that. It isn't even second-class. It's perhaps what I call the subclass parent. Because when you first come into the courts, you think that, well, all right, there's going to be a superior-inferior parent, which is inherently unconstitutional. There's no logic in the vast majority of mainstream cases for this very scenario to even exist. But they do it because this begets money transfers. When you get the money transfers, of course, that's a taxable event, and that's where you generate government income. But you don't, because it's much worse than that, because it starts off that fathers in particular and non-custodial mothers, those who waive their rights, that's their working women that are doing well, and they decide to concede their rights, and so they're in a second-class status. But they're much worse than that because over time, as the court process takes its course, you begin to get daycare providers, school teachers, you get the soccer coaches, you get babysitters even, that are held in higher regard in the way the court processes than even a father, a natural father, or a mother. And so what you eventually, when they finally get into the child support process, you become a subclass parent. By that I mean the parent that perhaps can't make ends meet, because when you get done with all the money you take out of the person, you know, the taxes and everything else, they're left with very little to live on. And so as a result, they default on these payments. But unlike the person who perhaps owes money in a debtor situation, and you're not supposed to have debtors for prisons, we outlawed that over 100 years ago, we've revived them in this very context. And so the person who's not able to keep up with these obligations eventually is either thrown in prison, a debtor's prison, if you will. Their license is taken. They are turned into something that is beneath that of the status of an illegal alien in America. Now, this is very real. I'm giving you a very practical perspective. This is going on all across America. And the civil rights violations are so wrong that somebody has to step up to the plate. And I did this. And the judges I speak to can't seem to come up with a logical response. And that's when I know I'm right. The sad part about it, I just don't have enough support to make this larger than it is right now. And I think eventually over time, it's going to happen simply because as the economy goes bad, more and more people are going to default, and you're going to see a lot more outrage over this in the days to come. But it is a civil rights grassroots movement, no question about it. But the question is, really, how can we elevate this? How can we get more people involved? And this Parenting Rights Convention that I'm going to have upstate New York perhaps is the answer, because it's a planning session designed to get a rally in Washington, D.C., so this problem can finally get noticed.
Gentlemen, let's take a moment here so that we can have a little bit of a station identification and bring Jim in, who's sitting in the outside vestibule, shall we say.
So let's... Hi, guys.
There he is.
Hello.
Jim is back.
So let me keep going just for a second here. Leon, let's stop for a second and talk about the Parenting Rights Convention. How can people find out more about that?
And Dr. McGuire, we have to take a moment and thank the many people that helped us make a lot of these things possible. And
certainly.
I can't thank you enough, Dr. Koziel, for being here, and Dr. Wardner, you're always so welcome. And wanted to thank the University of Michigan, the University of Detroit. In particular, we want to thank Chicago, Illinois, and the University of Rochester, and the University of Central Florida, and Full Sail University. I don't know why all these universities are visiting us. We're so happy to have you. I don't want you to think that these problems are going to face you, but perhaps by learning these things now, you can avoid these problems in the future. And I want to thank Mount Sinai Hospital and Xinzhu Hospital in Beijing, China, who have 19 different IP addresses listening to us this evening. You're so welcome. Welcome, Beijing. Welcome, Tokyo, Osaka, and Tokyo. Welcome, Japan. Gentlemen, proceed. Please go ahead, proceed.
I'm here.
Can they hear me?
I can hear you.
Okay, go ahead, proceed.
So Leon, as I was saying, let's talk about the Parenting Rights Convention that you got going for a minute. How can people find out more or get involved or attend? What's a good source of information for that?
Well, I'll give you a website, first of all, and people could sign on. We've got, just in the first day of our announcement, we got a lot of people that already signed on. In fact, one of the first ones was a gentleman out of New Zealand, and he said it's long overdue, and he's excited about it. It really has an international scope to it. But if you would just log in at www.leonkoziol.com, you will get all the information regarding the site. If you'd like to call me directly, it's area code 315-796-4000. That's 315-796-4000. The convention is designed to bring strategists together, perhaps delegates and leaders from around the country, different parenting organizations and groups, that could come together and plan the rally, ultimately, in Washington, D.C., and perhaps in state capitals around the country, and perhaps even countries, places even overseas for that matter, because much of this is affecting the free world. And I am surprised that actually some of the calls I'm getting from around the globe. And so programs like this, I think, are very useful because we reach out beyond our borders, and I think that's very important because this is about parents and their children. It is a natural right that goes beyond any sovereignty, beyond any sovereign claim or jurisdiction. This is something that is begets the very humanity, the civilization that we all enjoy today. It's a right that goes back to the beginning of time. And so when we talk about this parenting right, this parenting rights convention is a way for people to come together and talk about the topics of our day. Most of the things that I hear out there are symptoms of the problem rather than the core of it. And so let's talk about some of those symptoms. There's parent alienation, which is something that the system promotes because through this unequal classification of parents, the parent who is receiving the payments, what they call child support payments, wants to maintain that income, and so as a result, it is to that person's benefit to alienate the other parent. That is to say, to keep that parent from gaining any meaningful role in the child's life, because if that other parent is successful, well, then the other parent could then bring a custody challenge and threaten that welfare payment. I call it a welfare payment because there's no accountability for that money transfer from that second class or underclass or subclass parent. And so as a result, what you have is this phenomenon of civil rights violations where the parent that's alienating the subclass parent is allowed to get away with it because it supports the system. It supports the transfer payments. And so you see very little accountability. In fact, many judges don't even recognize the existence of parent alienation syndrome. It is very real, but the system actually supports it. And so the convention is designed to deal with issues like that. It's designed to deal with issues of parents who are going bankrupt by the system. It's about lawyer accountability, government transparency. It's about people coming together, and much like they did in 1848, a group of 100 men and women got together and formed a pact and said that we're going to change all this. And I think it's an important parallel, the important historical root to this, that in 1848, when 100 people got together and formed this pact, I mean, there were men that helped the women get ahead in life, to get out of that oppression that they were experiencing. And this parenting rights movement is very much dependent on women because much like the women, the men helped them out of their oppression in the 1800s, well, we're relying on women to help us, men, and of course non-custodial mothers, out of the oppression that we're experiencing today. Because all of us in the end are in this together. And we have to focus on, if we're going to do equality, we're going to talk about equality, then we have to apply it in all contexts. And this is a context where it's very antiquated, the whole idea of custody and non-custody. Perhaps that applies in situations where children have been abandoned or abused, but it does not apply to mainstream parents. The whole notion that when you walk into court, somebody is going to be declared a loser, somebody is going to be declared a subclass parent, is heinous. It's uncivilized because most people in the system are good parents to begin with. And then we come up with this concept that we've got to prove our fitness to the state. That's where it gets really crazy because who is the state to judge parenting? Many states like New York, California, these are states that are going into bankruptcy. They can't even manage their own budgets. The dysfunction in New York is particularized because studies have been conducted nationally by independent groups that has called the New York government a dysfunctional one. Now, how do we then rely upon that government to raise our children and then decide who is the relatively more fit parent? Because in these processes, these hearings, these trials, and so forth, the judge, she or he, perhaps is a bad parent. And how can they gauge who is the better parent in situations where it's largely orchestrated, you got carefully manipulated testimony, evidence that's scrutinized, bias that pervades the system, the money orientation that is behind it? How in the world does the state finally truly judge who is the better parent? And the bigger question is, why are we even doing that in the first place? We have in this country a diversified nation. We have what they call laboratories, different ways of doing things that hopefully the best arises, the cream of the crop. But what parenting, what person out there has the best parenting philosophy? There's no such thing. In fact, when you start talking that way, then you start placing a godlike figure upon yourself. Nobody really knows the best utopian parenting philosophy. So So why to engage in this process in the first place? The bigger question is, you know, how do we maximize the time that parents can spend with their children? How do we get them to work together? How do we provide the best parenting environment in the day and age where everything is working against them? Well, we certainly don't create superior and inferior parenting classifications and force people to fight over their own children. It is a barbaric contest. It is a barbaric process because this is going on in public courtrooms all across America. People are being destroyed. Hearts are being ripped out of good people. And children are being deformed in the process. It is totally unnecessary. It's heavily dependent on a money system. And it's time. It is our time. To say that we've had enough and to get the reform that's needed. So the parenting convention is designed to do exactly that. But nothing is going to happen until we're finally heard. Is it a problem or isn't it? But if it is, then we need to come together. And the parenting convention is designed to get everybody together and say, hey, what do we do? Let's have this rally. Let's all show up in June in Washington and let's be heard. Because that's the American way.
Jim, what do you have to say about that?
Leon, I have in front of me a American College Dictionary. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can.
I'm going to just read what it says about extort. This is the verb extort. To wrest or wring something from a person by violence, intimidation, or abuse of authority. Obtain money, information by force, torture, threat, or the like. To take illegally under cover of office. And then the noun, extortion, act of extorting. The crime of obtaining money or other things of value under color of office. When none is due or not so much is due or before it is due. Oppressive or illegal extraction. Anything extorted. Is it possible that the very act of having to go into a courtroom to gain access to your children is to lend yourself to the process of extortion?
No question about it. I mean, they should change, you know, custody hearing to extortion hearing. And I say that very matter-of-factly. You know, I mean, I've been through this. You know, I'm beyond that level of criticism that might be afforded to folks that are new to this or have practiced only a few years or perhaps haven't proven themselves. I mean, I got the largest casino in New York State declared unconstitutional up against large law firms. I've got my Juris Doctorate out of Illinois. I mean, and you know, references to Chicago. I lived there for a while. And this problem is going on all across America. When people go into these courtrooms, it is an extortion process. Let me put it to you this way, and I kind of touched off on this already, but if you can take your babies, your flesh and blood, the very extension of yourself, okay, and you can put those precious little ones between mom and dad, let's say only one of you are going to get these precious little babies. My God, I mean, if that's not extortion, I don't know what is. Because you know what? If you came to me and said, well, I want money from your law practice. I want this, that, and the other thing. I want your car. And if you don't, I'm going to do this, that, or the other thing. I'll gladly give up the car. And as I've done, I've even sacrificed my law practice. I've done it for my children because it does work. You know, when your children are, you know, you truly love your children, that is. You know, this whole discussion does not apply to people who could care less about their children. This is about loving mainstream parents all across America. And we would do anything for these children. And this is the beauty of it. This is that natural law exploitation that they have found, which I discussed earlier, which is at play in all of these proceedings. And so when you come into them and your child is at stake, you're being extorted. You know, this isn't about the sad part, it's also in addition to the extortion definition you gave. There is also an immense fraud occurring here. I mean, I read the opening paragraphs of my lawsuit in federal court, and I've called this a fraudulent system. That's very accurate. I mean, when they come in and say they're working for the best interests of the children, they're not. In fact, the statutes they don't even recognize children as your own children. They talk about, and read them, they're all in the books, they talk about the best interest of the child. I mean, what do you mean the child? Are the state's children? We're talking about your children and mine. There's a personal connection here. We begot those children. They were born in a biological fashion in which mom and dad have a completely biological equal existence in these children. Biologically, they are equal, but we're trying to do something different against the laws of nature. And it's a fraud to say that the state is looking out for your child or my child's best interest. They're not. What they're looking out for is a way to at least in modern day, I think the system originally started with a good goal. I think, you know, mostly when moms were at home and dads were working, the system perhaps made more sense. Not now, not today. Now what government has found is that a lot of money could be made off of this. And as we get into the forensic parts of this, think about it. You are not going to allow the court to say, look, pal, you're only going to be around for weekends, every other weekend, and that's going to be called good parenting. And that's not that. You can't be a weekend warrior, 2 weekends a month, and then proclaim that you're a good parent. But the government tells you that's good enough for dads, mostly dads, okay? And what do? We rebel against that. We say, wait a minute, I don't know what's going on at school, and mom's keeping away from the children because this gets her welfare check. You know, I'll give her the welfare check. Just let me see my children. But they don't do that. And as a result, you fight for those children. It's beautiful for the moneymakers. And then when you rebel against it, which is human nature, for all of you out there who are listening and saying, well, you've stood up in court and you know, you've showed what they call it, anger management. Anger management, that's simply something that says, put up with it. You know, go along with the fact that we are extorting money from you and that you should just be a subclass parent, is that we're taking the children from you here, and we're doing so without even compensating you for your loss. When you rebel against that, you are being a good parent. It's a natural reaction. They know this, but when you come and exemplify that natural, human, and commendable characteristic because you love your children, what do? Well, we're going to send you to anger management. We're going to send you, and I've seen so many clients subjected to this, and we're going to send you to an evaluator. My gosh, these people, many of them never had children. They haven't got the first idea how to raise them, and yet these are the ones who are controlling the destiny of your children's futures. And so, yes, it's extortion, but it's also a fraud. And there's such a combination of ills that are occurring here that you dare say it's criminal. Now, I know a lot of people have called me, and I get bombarded with calls all across the country, and many people keep bringing up this RICO Act. They believe that there's criminal involvement, a conspiracy of sorts between judges and government and all this sort of thing to take children away from good parents. You can't argue with these people. It's hard for me to really, you know, disagree with their concepts, but I think that's not the way to handle the problem. I think the first thing from a mainstream perspective is to bring the civil rights action, the test case that I have brought, and to get people behind it and say, you know, we've had enough, and we want to make our stand like we did in Brown v. Board of Education in 1954, separate but equal doctrine in our schools is inherently unconstitutional, inherently unequal, and it's going to be changed. And we spent 50 years, you know, changing what was hundreds of years of accepted wrongful discrimination. It was the mainstream at the time. And Roe v. Wade, you know, I don't agree with Roe v. Wade. That's just my personal view. I don't think there's such a privacy right under the Constitution, but they found it. They bypassed the legislatures. They bypassed that whole system of amending the Constitution, and they got a Supreme Court to rule that there's a privacy right in the Constitution. Well, let me say to you something very profound. If that is a privacy right, then there is a much greater privacy right in parents who love their children, want to raise them after they're born. And again, the Supreme Court has called it the oldest liberty interest recognized under the Constitution. But we have Justice Scalia, for example, on the Supreme Court who's saying, well, perhaps this right isn't even protected under the Constitution. If I could have just a couple other moments, I just want to say this. There is an amendment, the parentsrights.org. It's a wonderful organization, prominent people working together to try to do an amendment. They want to pass an amendment to the United States Constitution that says that the parenting rights is a fundamental right and should be protected. And I think it's a great idea. But here's the problem we have with that. We shouldn't have to pass an amendment to declare something that is already protected by the Constitution. Supreme Court has already declared this the oldest liberty interest under our Constitution. So why pass an amendment to declare it? If you're going to seek to make the amendment, inherently you're saying that it's not protected. And I don't agree with that whole movement. I like it. I applaud what they're trying to do. But I think it's the wrong approach. This right, this parenting right, is already protected. And when these courts come in and they mangle it, they absolutely torture it by throwing forensic people and therapists and lawyers and law guardians and judges, and half of them don't even know what they're doing, and tell us how to raise our children, we have a serious problem. And I think the court should be involved only in those cases where children have been neglected, abused. That has been the constitutional standard, by the way, over the past couple hundred years, I guess. But when money gets involved, everything changes. And so we have to look at the multi-billion dollar industry. That is the beast, if you will, and it's a difficult one to overcome. We have to get together. We have to do what we Americans do best. We have to organize, and that's what this parenting convention is all about.
Leon, as soon as father gets kicked out of the house, he becomes a non-entity, a non-parent. If he's lucky, he gets to be a visitor. What do you suppose the chances are that very many men know what it's going to cost in dollars, in sweat and labor, to get back into a position where they can even functionally be a visitor, an accepted non-supervised visitor, to their own children? Do you think very many of them have any idea the tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of dollars it's going to cost, and even then they may never see their kids again?
They haven't got the foggiest idea. It's a sad commentary. They're sheep to slaughter. They are deer in the headlights. I hate to say it. I've seen it in the courts. They come in believing that there's justice, that the blind justice, you know, the scales of justice are equal when they walk in, and they're not. And they are targets. And you have all of that, the male stereotypes that are at play. You know, I've seen them try to work that against me. You know, if they can get you to get upset in court because you're already the inferior parent, and you throw the slightest of emotion. Oh, my gosh, there you go. What kind of a parent are you? You know, you're showing your temper tantrum. Well, you know, fathers and men in particular are programmed genetically different than women are. It's a natural thing. It goes back, you know, thousands of years. How do we, you know, suddenly change because somebody decided to make the big money off of the system and apply politically correct concepts to something that simply, you know, like a square peg, round hole here? Fathers don't understand what they're getting into. And, you know, I hate to say this, but in so many cases, my advice would be to fire your lawyer. You're going to probably get the same result representing yourself than you will with the lawyer at your side. In fact, I'm offering seminars. I'm saying I will help people to represent themselves. In these seminars, I have a group out of Ohio that's asked me to come out there and get into this through experience, you know, of representing oneself and how you can go about doing this. Because the result's probably not going to be much different. You might even get more sympathy trying to represent yourself. Sadly, when you're giving all these money to the lawyers, and then if you talk about child support payments, you know, I mean, is it really child support? This money is used in an ongoing, you know, custody contest by the recipient of these support payments to pay for her lawyer or his lawyer. In the end, all the money that's intended for the children are going to litigation expenses. Now, how is this real child support?
Well, it got worse than that, Leon. It got worse than that for some of us because we had to pay the child support, we had to pay the ex's attorneys, in my case, her two attorneys at the same time because one wasn't good enough because she was a Hollywood star, and then we had to pay our own attorney as well. And I don't think that the attorneys, when you go in there, tell you right up front that the best they might be able to get you is a couple weekends a month. And, oh, by the way, pack your bags.
They don't tell you this, and sadly, when you, again, we go back to the scales of justice, it so tips the scales, it so tortures and perverts the justice system that you're walking into something entirely different. And that's why what I call this is the custodial institution of child rearing. Now think about this for a minute. When you go in there, look at the terms they use, custody, visitation. These are terms common to prison communities. They talk about restraint orders, protection orders, supervised visitation. You brought that up just a little while ago. These are the types of provisions that are common to the punishments that are meted out in criminal courts. Now, how in the world are we applying this type of thinking, this institutional setting, to the raising of delicate, innocent, even infant children. Where is our logic? Where is our common sense? What has happened to our moral compass, our moral fiber as a nation, when we are taking children and thrusting them into that type of a regulatory environment? That is what I call the custodial institution of child rearing. That is what I'm challenging in federal court. I'm seeking an order declaring it unconstitutional so that perhaps we could go back into something much more civilized. We have some of this in Australia, for example, where they're focused more on parenting orders rather than these power titles and welfare awards, okay? And these parenting orders would simply say in any given setting where parents aren't getting along, living separately, that we're going to define how much time divided roughly equal between the parents, and we're going to show, you know, we're going to just take care of the conflicts. But we're not going to get involved in children's lives unless the state, you know, somebody's on public assistance, for example. Unless somebody's on public assistance and government is actually spending for the rearing of the children, the state has no interest. There is no logical state interest to get involved and dictate that money should transfer between one parent and the other. And, of course, if you don't have the custodial, the inferior, superior parents involved, then you can't have the money transfers. So it becomes more logical. You understand the system a lot better when you begin to see that you have to have a superior and inferior parent to justify the money transfers, without which money doesn't transfer, government doesn't get its revenues, lawyers don't profit, and a multi-billion-dollar industry will decline dramatically. And I think that would be a great thing, because then our nation would get back to doing what it does best, productivity. Rather than entire families being hauled into these kangaroo courts, which is what Justice Abe Fortress called it. This is not me talking. A United States Supreme Court justice called this process, these courts, kangaroo courts. Instead of us, our families, our employers, business people, relatives, all running into these courts, arguing like a bunch of children, sometimes acting worse than the children themselves, and we're not spending time at work. And even then, when the custody cases and all these battles are over with, we go back to our workplaces. We're not focused. We are so distraught over the taking of our children, that's really what's occurring here, that we don't perform as we should. As a result, countries like China are getting way ahead of us. So this is much more than just, as you know, one lawyer in one of my cases said, well, this is just a terrible divorce case. It's much more than that. When you take a look at it, what's going on all across the country, our entire productivity is going down. Healthcare costs are on the uprise because of this. And if our national leaders would understand that this is the problem, this is a bigger problem than people are giving it, we might correct ourselves even as a nation. So I really think this parenting convention, the seminars, people being able to represent themselves and making their own statements, and why not? Think about that for a minute, gentlemen. If you can go into court and say, wait a minute, you're taking my child. Oh, no, we're not. Cousin. No, wait a minute. Judge, you're taking my boy. You're taking my girl. Now let's talk it from that perspective. I think the judgments would change if enough people were saying that on their own in court and saying, we don't want these lawyers because they are making money off of this. We want to be able to make our pitch in court because you have that right under the First Amendment of the United States Constitution, that clause, that least read clause, that says you have a right to petition your government for redress of grievances. This is different than the common and famous ones, the ones we all know about, free speech, you know, free religion, free press. The last clause of the First Amendment says you have a right to petition your government. And so when you go there, you want to make sure your petitions are correct and honest and properly conveyed. If you don't understand how the system works, how can you convey your petition? And if the person on your left and right is a lawyer that's making it off the system and is geared and programmed to make the arguments as they've always known it, how will the truth get out? How will you be able to make your case in court? So that's why I believe that pro se litigation, people representing themselves, may be the answer if enough people are doing that. And it's something I'm offering in the way of seminars. But hopefully through this convention,
Leon,
we can get the word out.
Let me break in here for just a quick minute because we're getting toward the end. I do realize this, but there's a lot of listeners who listen to this show. Can you tell them how to get more information on the pro se option?
I don't think it's out there, sadly, folks. You know, it's not like there's a book on it. It's not like there's anybody doing this. I'm doing it, but I'm kind of like way ahead of the pack here, way ahead of the curve. And, you know, and they've retaliated against me, as I'm sure you know. They have retaliated in a manner I never even imagined was possible, not to the extreme that they did, to actually, you know, concoct things, you know, go back 10 years and find any complaint that was ever made by any client, including criminals and, you know, drug dealers, and say that these are subtly honest people. It's sad. It's scary that you would have this happen. But in any event, I don't really, there's no such program out there that I'm aware of. I'm offering it because I've seen the inside, and I think if more people did it, you know, more courts would be aware of it, and then there would be more talk about it. And the 2006 Matrimonial Commission report to the Chief Justice of the State of New York, there was no mention of gender bias. There was no mention of the gross disparity found in our Census Bureau statistics. These are regularly available U.S. Census Bureau statistics that state 85% of all people paying child support are men, and 10% of custody battles, you know, go to men. Now, that is such a gross disparity. You'd think at the very least they would recognize this in a heavily costly taxpayer-financed report now, a study that was done, and you would think they would at least recognize it. Because if you don't recognize the problem, how are you going to correct it? You're not going to set up. You're not going to go about correcting it. But yet in the same report, they said that judges, a survey of judges now, they found that domestic relations assignments were considered, quote-unquote now, punishment assignments. At the same time, the unified court system in the state of New York brought an action against the other two branches of government and said, we want increases in our pay from $136,000 annually. And many of the complaints that were in the pleadings were from anonymous judges that were complaining that they couldn't provide, you know, weddings for their daughters, for example. Well, the same system is bankrupting good parents. And many parents are not even able to go to their children's weddings, let alone pay for them. So we have a certain kind of elite classification going on here between judge victims and regular, the rest of us, you and I, that are victimized by the system. How do you justify pay raises when they don't, when they're considering these, the most important assignments, to be punishment assignments? They are not punishment assignments because they're the future of our very nation. Our children are our future. And so while I'm offering it, my thinking is if we have this convention and we have the proper rally in Washington, D.C., because they've got to hear from us, that's the way to get reform. The test cases, the constitutional rights cases that I'm pursuing, I have several of them working their way through state and federal court, will hopefully get the United States Supreme Court. I filed a petition with the U.S. Supreme Court. But we, we're a small group, and we need to.
You know, the problem, Leon, is we have so many good men who do nothing. We got a lot of people watching the Super Bowl, but we don't have enough people seeking redress through our supposed leaders and representatives.
I agree.
Leon, we're out of time. Thank you. We'd like to have you back.
It was a pleasure to be here. I want to commend you guys for the work that you do. I wish wish you well and wish many more programs like this, and hopefully this will have an impact down the road.
Leon, give your website again real quick, if you would.
www.leon, L-E-O-N, Kozol, K-O-C-I-O-L, .com. And that area code 315. 796-4000.
And once again, I urge all of you, those of you who feel that this show has value and merit, and you like what you hear, to tell your friends to come to Men Matters on syndicatednews.net every Friday at 8 o'clock and hear more of these types of shows with people like Leon Kozol, who's been very brave under a lot of duress. And we appreciate all your listeners very much. Good night, everybody.